Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the sometimes forgotten but influential women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. So if any of you thought, by our title, The Revolutionary Politics of Motherhood, that I was going to discuss some political movement in modern motherhood, you would be very wrong. However, I do have to share that our oldest daughter left for her second year of college a few weeks ago now, and the youngest started high school this year, so I feel like I'm a bit on the downhill slope. The second one is really quiet as well, so it's easy to feel peaceful in my house these days. And I'm beginning to visit my friends that have little ones and actually enjoy the chaos and noise. Believe me when I say that the mothers we are discussing today had far bigger problems than how to fit the endless carpool hours into their schedule. But I'd like to think that I can identify with them a little bit as a mother who wants the best for her children and the nation we live in. Any guess from the title as to what our topic is this week? Well, I'll tell you. Our nation was young, and we were facing the amazing task of shaking off that pesky feeling of ownership that England felt for all this fabulously luxurious land we have here in the U.S. So how do you win on the world stage, raise some awesome kids who will become even more awesome citizens? Now, mind you, these women didn't have the challenges we moms face today in trying to raise functional human beings, and you can insert your favorite insult to modern intellectual culture here, but they did have their own social dynamics to overcome. The name of the method that evolved when these founding mothers became the social force behind raising citizens of this new United States was Republican motherhood. This is not the mothering of a Republican, but rather mothering the founders of our republic, and they began the race from behind, pretty much. These were not moms who were prepared for this. The ideal women in the wealthy northeastern families living during the 18th century was fairly useless to a fledgling country, and they certainly weren't invited to participate in politics. Of course, we know and we have discussed that many of these women were very involved in running the family business, and the wife in most farm families produced and sold some product or found a way to contribute to the family income, but this was not the strived-for ideal among the elites, who were often the most political. These women were expected to be very stylish, slender, and poised. I think the craziest thing I have heard of in this era was to manipulating figures was strapping young women to a backboard at night to improve their posture. I am guessing a chiropractor would have been a popular guy during this era if one had been available. There were still women that wore some loose skirts that farm women had worn for years, but the fashions of the wealthy were becoming ridiculous. The heels were very high and made of wood, so normal walking was almost impossible, and corsets covered a good portion of the middle of the body. Masks were often worn if a woman left the house during the day to save her skin from the sun, and they never left the house without gloves. Hair was piled high on the top of their heads, which was most likely a fashion adopted from the British and French women at the time. If you haven't read The Duchess by Amanda Foreman, you may have seen the dramatic adaptation starring Keira Knightley, where she wears, has the huge headdress with the gigantic feathers. Even before that time, hairdos were high and crazy with all sorts of decorations. This stayed the trend until Marie Antoinette decided to go all milkmaid on everyone, and then the Jane Austen era was ushered in. So it kind of calmed down after that, but we're still in the middle of, the Duchess era at this point. Even crazier, the little girls were dressed the same way. So you have women with time to spend on things like fashion, and other women in towns that were not wealthy, mirroring at least a few of these social trends that were becoming popular. They called on one another quite often and spent time in their separate sphere, which would now create a social network that benefited the nation greatly when helping the cause of the patriotic war on home turf. As a military wife, we hear jokes about the wives network. I'm using my quote fingers all the time. Well, spouses network now, and while some people don't see the benefit, we have many active duty friends that realize after a while it can be a powerful tool around a base when a squadron is deployed. So politics began to get dicey, and all of a sudden, men of the colonies realized defeating their massive opponent and gaining freedom would take more than just their effort. while their wives, mothers, and sisters and daughters sat at home waiting. And thus women became important to politics. These women had a vested interest in freedom. The cost of goods in their homes and availability of land, a living and freedom, in some ways affected the wife more than the husband. It was a woman named Sarah Jay who, in her personal letter, penned the famous line, "What do I have to do with politics?" spelled with the well-recognized CK. She wasn't a bad speller, by the way. The use of personal phonetic spellings was really common at the time. So when the British government began expecting whole families, including women and children, to declare allegiance, more fuel was just thrown on this fire of, you know, what was affecting these women and their families and homes. And all of a sudden, a population of very effective boycotters was born. One of my favorite sort of take back the night moments was in 1778 in Boston, when some women believed a merchant to be hiding stores of coffee. They manhandled him, broke into the warehouse, and took the coffee. Now, I'm not advocating a Robin Hood approach, but women had previously been thought of incapable of this type of public action. We have all heard about the sewing bees and refusing to drink the tea and coffee, wearing homespun clothes, especially in the South, and doing more with less and less. We know about women like Deborah Sampson, who dressed like a man to fight as a soldier, and we know how women ran the family farms and small businesses with British soldiers looming, suffering severe hardships, including torture and rape. It is important for the population to rationally separate themselves from their oppressors. So Sarah Evans gives this succinct summary of the thought process that led from proactive spouses to Republican mothers, creating the citizens that would make a nation strong as they realized they had to intellectually develop themselves as patriots and separate themselves from these British soldiers who were quartering in their homes. Europe offered a powerful critique of aristocratic society premised on the subordination of one class to another. Articulating a worldview rooted in the rising commercial middle classes, they emphasized the infinite perfectibility of the individual. Through education, people could abandon the superstition and irrationality of tradition. Educated citizens became the foundation of a rational and just republican social order. Federalists believed that the power relied on the will of the people, and now, of course, there were restrictions on this view from our founding fathers, but an ideal was born and spread to the home and family. Women would not become citizens, but they would participate in the process of nation building. We have discussed the relief societies and charities as well as some political activism, but educating the new generation of citizens became widely virtued as the challenge of the patriotic woman. This was her role and her identity. She would teach loyalty with reading and arithmetic, a thirst for knowledge and freedom with history and perhaps a little Latin. Now, her children might go to school if living in a town where schools were available, or attend an academy if the money was available. But regardless of where the academies, of where the academics were learned, the loyalty and the patriotism were lessons of necessity in the home. So now we have a problem. Back to the beginning of our podcast. How does a silly woman who was taught to read and do basic arithmetic, but that could sew, quilt, sing, and do all this while she was, of course, in these ridiculous get-ups and, you know, strapped to a backboard at night, teach her children more than she was taught? And when that question came up, the colonists and the new citizens knew what they had to do. Educating women exploded and expanded. By the time Catherine Beecher, see how I like to go back to her, came along, women were already learning more than they had before the era of Republican motherhood. And the advent of public schools in northeastern towns was huge, a huge movement. In Massachusetts, by 1789, there were references made to schoolmistresses who would work for less than their male counterparts, of course. These women were the mothers of female seminaries that led to the statistics of today where more females attend college than males. So this might seem like a small thing to us, this movement from the late 1700s. And even though I rarely talk about our more famous American women in history, I think I have to name drop to show how influential the pearls of Republican motherhood really were. Our most famous, in my opinion, was Abigail Adams. I don't even know how many great things I could say about her. There's just an infinite amount of those. She was educated by her preacher father and could rival any man with her knowledge of political theory, foreign languages, and the ability to make a man like a fool, look like a fool. How can we forget the Remember the Ladies letter? Abigail does not persuade her husband to argue for equal citizenship for women, but she sure does make a point that we still read and study today. Eliza Pinckney, who, in addition to her own accomplishments as a businesswoman and inventor, wrote to her powerful friends that the colonies were not well protected enough. Or Mercy Otis Warren, who left countless poems, plays, and histories of the Revolutionary period that are still famous today, were all women of influence that raised citizens and the bar of achievement for all women. But I think one of my favorites, not because she was an Abigail Adams by any means, but just because it was a good story, is the common law Mrs. Franklin, Deborah Reed. Deborah married another man after Ben, to whom she was engaged, left for England and didn't return in a timely manner. Her husband was a bum, to say the least, her first husband. The historical account, as written by Cokie Roberts, said that she was married off by her mother, so perhaps not all her fault, who disappeared. He disappeared one day. Ben and Deborah couldn't marry because there was no proof that John Roberts, her husband, who had spent her dowry on a trip to the West Indies, had died. So she and Ben moved in together, but let me tell you, he got the good end of that deal. She helped run his printing shop as well as a sundry shop where she sold a crown soap that was sought after all over town. So while she birthed a son who died at age 4 and then a daughter named Sally, raising and educating them, she also helped run Franklin's new gig, postmaster for all the colonies. Ben retires and becomes an inventor, we know today, the kindly man with his glasses and kite in hand. But let's just say that this was not the whole portrait of Mr. Franklin. He went as a representative from Pennsylvania to the crown and remained in London for years at a time. And guess who kept the postal system afloat? Yep, that would be Deborah. And how does Ben repay her? Well, he takes up with a woman named Margaret Stevenson, who had a daughter named Polly. Deborah was encouraged by some to go to England, but she did not want to, and she faithfully wrote to her husband. But apparently, on top of being a philanderer, he liked to criticize her political views and told her she should keep in her place. So the brilliant woman whose business acumen kept Ben afloat and helped make him wealthy was beneath him, he believed. And you see the pattern here? Are you seeing the pattern? Really? Ben Franklin was kind of an ass. So in this era, Ben the chauvinist was a founding father who did not educate his daughter the same way he would have a son, though she herself was a Republican mother. She warned him of the violent reaction that would meet the Stamp Act. This is Sally, by the way, his daughter. But when Franklin was communicating with Parliament, he grossly underestimated the reaction of the lawmaking body. When he took the bold step of proposing a candidate for stamp collector after the Stamp Act passed in Philadelphia, figuring that someone would have to do the job. Anyway, now that the act had passed, a mob ensued. Deborah protected their property and daughter, and Ben continued on with his shenanigans with women like Katie Ray, who would eventually marry a man who became the governor of Rhode Island. So, here's my soapbox statement. I have to pause here to get on my soapbox for a minute. Both of my daughters have had one remarkable history teacher in their years of history. The oldest in her junior year of high school, and the youngest this year, which is her freshman year in high school. And the common theme for my admiration of both of these teachers, in addition to a wicked sense of humor, is the ability to draw the students in with the occasional tidbit of what I like to call historical gossip. Now, if you knew all this about Benjamin Franklin in high school, don't you think you would have remembered more about him than just the fact that he was an inventor? Because even though I don't seem to have much nice to say about him, he was a brilliant man who left a wonderful legacy of international diplomacy as well as a few cool inventions. John Adams was much more respectful to his wife than Franklin, but diplomacy took a while to master. So John Adams wasn't very good at that at first. Franklin learned to fit right in with whomever he wanted to negotiate. So I'm stepping down now a little bit. So you've got this woman who influenced this nation so greatly, but yet she was still considered less than her husband. And now we know that he probably wouldn't have been the man he was. It would have affected the entire future of our nation if Deborah had not been the woman she was. So was the Republican mother just a teacher giving instructions on how to raise patriotic sons, or was she aware of the importance of the fledgling state of the new nation? Well, Abigail Adams, certainly not, again, a forgotten woman in American history, but certainly one to quote, answered that when she wrote to her sister of her concern when General Washington became ill in 1790, that she feared the nation and its finances would fail if the figurehead of the nation died at this point. And I have no doubt that she was on to something, especially since Alexander Hamilton was dealing with a mountain of war debt at the time. There are still seats in both the House and Senate, the galleys, that were dubbed the Ladies' Gallery, because there were so many of them that took the time to come and listen to their lawmakers, for whom they could not vote, but they came to watch laws created that would then be upheld by their sons. She began to expect romantic love, this Republican mother, in marriage, and the idea of Democratic Republic of the government spread to marriage, with the idea of the matrimonial Republican in Ladies Magazine in 1792. That was actually the title of it, Ladies Magazine. The author, a woman, wrote that the word obey should be stricken from the ceremony, that should represent a union of interests where differences were accommodated by conference. I love this ideal of the Republic, but it is sort of funny that love and politics would mix this way, doesn't it always? Even more, there are countless letters where women discuss the nuances of politics and nation building far beyond what their fathers, husbands, brothers, and sons gave them credit for. So, these women were amazing. They educated a nation, not just by sitting down and teaching their children things, but by being examples for their sons and daughters to follow. So, what did this educational movement really do in the long-term effect on the United States? Well, how does a movement to educate women affect any society? I think it becomes clear when we have programs like teams of Marine women who have visited Afghani villages to communicate with Afghani women. It seems like an awfully big investment and dangerous investment to make, targeting only half a population and not the half traditionally fighting the wars, if we did not have a reasonable expectation of a positive result. And then there is Malala Yousafzai. I apologize for butchering her name. The 15-year-old girl, by the way, the British hospital treating her just corrected her age recently from 14 to 15, who was shot at point-blank range by the Taliban for championing education for girls. Why would this be necessary if there was not a fear of great change in society when women are educated? If our infant nation had not required the intellect of half the population that was not allowed to vote and helping to raise good citizens, would women like Catherine Beecher have come along to challenge even further the traditional thinking of education for women? Yes, there were, again, female teachers in some schools before and during the Revolution, but would the nationwide push to make teaching a female profession have allowed women the ability to make a living any other way than piecework, domestic work, and factory work? Would we have been a nation like Switzerland that did not allow its female citizens to vote until 1971? We study history to understand our past and make better decisions in our future, and now there are more women studying at universities in the United States than men. So thank you, mothers of the Republic. Though I didn't know how I should appreciate you when I was in school, I can give you a shout out now as this week's History's Hotties. Well, that wraps up this episode. If you have any questions, comments, or snide remarks, all of which we accept, please email us at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's historieshotties@yahoo.com. Just skip the apostrophe. Or visit our Facebook page entitled History's Hotties. So until next time.